Good morning. First case this morning is United States v. Harpole. The appellant ready to argue?
Yes, Chief Judge.
Government?
Yes, Chief Judge.
Thank you. Appellant may argue.
Good morning, Chief Judge, judges of the court. May it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Commander Jason Roberts, and with Mr. James Trishman, who is not present today, I represent the appellant, Seaman Harpole. Chief Judge, I respectfully request 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Seaman Harpole's statements to Petty Officer Knipp were inadmissible. Either they were inadmissible under the victim-victim advocate privilege, or they were inadmissible under Article 31B. And the failure to submit a motion to suppress those statements under Article 31B after the counsel had received the military judge's ruling was ineffective.
Okay, let's cut to the chase. How does the privilege apply when he's not the victim? The rule clearly says the privilege holder is the victim. He's not the victim.
Respectfully, Chief Judge, he is a victim.
A victim of what?
A victim of a sexual offense for which he suffered direct physical or emotional harm, which is straight from the definition of MRE 514. The definition found in MRE 514 does not say...
He's the aggrieved party here.
He is an aggrieved
then
person.
Then why is he the accused and why is he the appellant?
Well, he's the accused because of the government's charging decision.
Okay, the government's charging decision.
However,
but how can he assert the privilege? He's not the victim.
He's not the victim for the charge, Your Honor. But the definition of victim in MRE 514 says any person who is alleged to have suffered direct physical or emotional harm as a result of a sexual or violent offense.
Okay, and what sort of harm did he suffer?
Well, Your Honor, looking at the record, what he said to Petty Officer Knipp was, I feel the same way I did when I was previously sexually assaulted in the past. So he suffered some emotional or psychological harm. The contours of that, the specifics of that are hard to say, but truth be told, his statement to Petty Officer Knipp was really no different than the statement made by the alleged victim, in this case to the CGIS office. So if he's not a victim, then really she would be no more of a victim either, because her statement was almost exactly the same. I think something sexual happened and I don't remember. The application of the privilege ultimately...
Counsel, just to follow up on that, if a person visits a victim advocate and no charges are brought against either that person or the person that's the subject of the discussion with the victim advocate, and the person who visited the victim advocate claim the 514 privilege if that person is called as a witness in an unrelated court-martial?
Your Honor, if I understand correctly, the person that you're talking about is, in this case, the victim. Can that person claim the
Let's
victim?
Let's say Jones says, I'm a victim, and he has a discussion with a victim advocate. No charges are ever brought against Smith, who Jones talked about, and no charges are ever brought about against Jones. In an unrelated court-martial, Jones, the person who visited the victim advocate, is called as a witness and is asked about his or her discussions with the victim advocate. Can Jones claim the privilege in that unrelated court-martial, saying, I'm a victim, I went to visit a victim advocate, and I claim the 514 privilege for my discussions with the victim advocate?
Your Honor, based on the plain language of 514, it would appear to be so. The general rule states that a victim has a privilege to prevent disclosure from confidential communications made to a victim advocate.
And is there anything in the rule that says the person who claims that privilege has to be this, a named person in charge under the UCMJ?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Ultimately, where the issue turns is whether the communication made to Petty Officer Knipp was a confidential communication. And this rule is found in United States versus Shelton.
So why was it confidential in light of the fact that appellant brought with him a friend?
Your Honor, it was confidential because the friend, Seaman Shoulders, truthfully, truth be told, more than a friend, a shipmate and a roommate, was a person who furthered the rendition.
So a shipmate and roommate is more than a friend?
There's certainly more a closer connection, I believe, than just simply being a friend. The shipmate term, and I don't mean to get into the weeds, but shipmate has a very specific term in application to the military, more than, say, a friend would.
So how was his presence a rendition of assistance?
Yes, Your Honor. The record indicates that but for Seaman Shoulders prompting to Seaman Harpole to go talk to a victim advocate, he probably would not have gone to a victim advocate.
Does that translate into the need to have him present during that conversation with the victim advocate?
Well, Your Honor, the record continues in that as Seaman Shoulders testified at the preliminary hearing, Seaman Harpole was nervous, was going through a hard time, more or less, talking to the victim advocate, and he was there for support.
But does moral support rise to the level of what we're contemplating when it comes to the privilege about rendering assistance?
It could, Your Honor, as long as there's some evidence that support, even if it's moral, even if it's emotional or what have you, furthered the rendition of the services.
And is the assistance, is it being rendered to the person who is going to the victim advocate, or is that assistance being rendered to the victim advocate in terms of providing assistance?
The plain language of the rule says furthers the rendition of services. So in this case, where the military judge had erred in her conclusions of law was more or less changing the plain language of the word, the rendition, to render, and then examined it from the point of view of the victim advocate rendering services. But that's contrary to the plain language. It's a totality of the circumstances that one should look to in seeing were services being rendered, was the presence of this third party furthering the rendition of the services. And here, there's...
What about the fact that everything he told the victim advocate is exactly what he'd already told Childers? I mean, doesn't that give you problems? Even if we accepted your argument that somehow his shipmate was necessary to facilitate his report to the victim advocate, the fact that he told the victim advocate what he'd already told someone else?
Well, I have 2 points to that, Your Honor. One, the testimony that came out at trial indicated that what Seaman Childers said was different from what the government had alleged occurred in that communication. The defense counsel called Seaman Childers to rebut the claims of Petty Officer Nip on two key points. One, that Seaman Harpole had said that his wife had cheated on him during the patrol, and the second point, that Seaman Harpole had said the alleged victim in this case had opened the door to the birthing area. Seaman Childers was called to rebut both of those claims. So they weren't identical. But as to the second point, Your Honor, about whether, suppose hypothetically, he had said the exact same thing, there's no pre-communication waiver of a confidential communication. Even the Coast Guard Court of Criminal Appeals had noted in front
of... No, but there's certainly a waiver of any privilege if it's communicated to a third party. And the fact that he's there as some sort of handholder doesn't abrogate that.
I would respectfully disagree, Chief Judge. Even Judge Crawford, in her dissent in United States versus Shelton, had indicated that disclosure to a third party in some cases is not going to waive the privilege, as long as that person further, in that case, the clergy penitent privilege, as long as that person furthered or was reasonably necessary for the transmission of the communication, had furthered the services from the clergyman.
Well, how far does that extend? Let's say that an individual has three best friends, or in your formulation, three other roommates, earthmates, shipmates, and goes in and says, I need these three people here for moral support. Doesn't that vitiate the concept of confidentiality?
Your Honor, I believe, though, the Shelton would still govern in this case. It would be what was the intent of the individual to maintain confidentiality. While it certainly would seem a bit unorthodox to have that many people come with you in a confidential setting, if the intent was to have all those people together present to keep it confidential because I needed all those people, as long as there's evidence on the record to support that and it's credible, then the intent of the communicant is clear, and therefore there would be a privilege, as long as that there is evidence that that furthered the rendition of services.
So in your analysis, when would something become not confidential?
Well, something would not be confidential either if there's no evidence in the record that of the intent to maintain the confidentiality. But ultimately, then you really would have to be dealing with whether there was a waiver, whether there was a permission of an authorized disclosure to be made after the communication had already been made in a confidential setting.
But don't we have a presumption against privileges? Don't we have a situation where we're concerned about the truth-seeking function of a court-martial? And the burden is on the person asserting the privilege to prove it. So you're talking about there having to be evidence in the record and so forth that would vitiate the confidential nature of it. Don't you have the burdens misplaced there?
Well, there is a presumption that in such cases privileges are waived. Unless there's evidence to the contrary, but
and they're also narrowly construed.
That's correct, Chief Judge.
Go ahead.
While there is a privilege or a presumption that privileges are waived, it's somewhat circular because the test is whether there was the intent to maintain confidentiality, as found in Shelton, and that should apply to all privileges.
Lieutenant Commander Roberts. Isn't it more than just the intent, though? Don't we have to examine the relationship between the person who's with the counselee or the person being counseled? I mean, in Shelton, you had a husband and wife situation, did you not?
Yes, you did.
Now, you're not arguing that that relationship is akin to these two shipmates, are you? I hope not. But
well, they weren't married.
And that's good to know.
Yes, Your Honor.
Could be.
It's not the same as being married. The argument ultimately isn't going to turn on the closeness of the relationship, because also in Shelton, the court had said, we're not going to define the parameters for when or what kind of third party needs to be present. For our purposes, really in this case, it's sufficient that they had a close marital or blood tie. But the court seemed to be open to the notion that it's not just limited to people who have special blood relationships. If anything, that might be a presumption for why that person would have that that third party in a confidential setting.
Counsel, in most of the privileges that we've discussed today are not dependent upon the governmental status of the person who's receiving the communication, whether we're talking about clergies, spouses, they could be lawyers, they could be governmental or non-governmental. Here we have a situation in which the recipient is, as I understand it, always a governmental official. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Advocates and DOD's Safe Helpline staff victim privilege. In that situation, if a person who believes they're a victim goes to talk to that individual, whose responsibility is it to tell the individual who's coming in for the conference that that person has created circumstances which will make the conversation no longer privileged? That is it the responsibility of the government official who's conducting the meeting, or is it the responsibility of the individual who's coming into the meeting to know that they've done something that will create a non-privileged conversation?
Well, Your Honor, the Coast Guard policy for our sexual assault prevention response program would seem to put the burden on the government official, because that person, in this case a victim advocate, is someone who can receive either a restricted report or an unrestricted report, which is available at the communicant's option. So if, for example, the communicant wanted to make a restricted report, then the burden should be on the government official to notify the communicant of that.
And what did the record tells us whether there was an atmosphere created here, either expressly or implicitly, that would leave the person making the complaint in this case to believe it or not believe that the conversation was privileged? What do we have in the record that would tell us? In other words, did someone indicate that this was going to be a confidential communication, or is it simply inferred from the circumstances?
From what the record shows that this would be a confidential communication is that Petty Officer Nip had said she took Seaman Harpel and Seaman Childers to a berthing area in order to give them privacy, which Seaman Harpel accepted. So the circumstances there indicate that this was to be a private setting, not out in the open.
And did the accused in this case, the appellant in this case, say anything, or did Nip say anything to indicate an understanding of why the third party was present?
Petty Officer Nip did say that because Seaman Childers was present, it would be an unrestricted report, because she knew Seaman Childers was not authorized to take restricted reports.
Counsel, before your time expires, would you be willing, please, to turn your attention to your ineffective assistance of counsel claim as it pertains to the Article 31B rights issue?
Yes, Your Honor. Petty Officer Nip was a person subject to the code, and she had suspicion that Seaman Harpel was an offender. Petty Officer Nip was also a superior in the chain of command. There's evidence in the record that Seaman Harpel actually would work for Petty Officer Nip.
How do we get to her interrogation, that prong of the test under 31B?
Yes, Your Honor. And this is where the ineffectiveness is most strong, because the record only indicates that Petty Officer Nip had said, well, tell me why you're here. And there was no subsequent questioning thereafter, at least according to Petty Officer Nip. However, had the counsel developed a record to challenge that narrative, they could have called Seaman Harpel to testify to something differently.
Does that put you in a bind, though? And I mean that this way. You've raised an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. We need to be able to find a basis for that in the record. You're indicating that the record wasn't developed. For our purposes, with an IAC claim, undeveloped record, isn't it very difficult for our court to find ineffective assistance?
It is difficult, Your Honor, and I would recommend the portion of the opinion from the Coast Guard Court of Criminal Appeals that did note that when Seaman Harpel raised matters pursuant to U.S. v. Grostefan, there were portions in his matters that indicated he would have challenged the claims by Petty Officer Nip as to that interrogation. Now, the court didn't consider it because there wasn't an affidavit attached to the record, but there's a reasonable belief that could have happened, that he could have then testified to something different.
What information is in the record about what Nip knew about the allegations by GR before he came and spoke to her?
Chief Judge, my time's expired. May I answer the question?
Answer the question.
The evidence in the record, Your Honor, is that when the report by the alleged victim was made, there was a direct communication from a superior officer to Petty Officer Nip. Now, we don't know why she contacted Petty Officer Nip, but it's more than coincidental that the person had knowledge that Seaman Harpel was the offender. The person who was the superior officer knew Seaman Harpel had been working for Petty Officer Nip. There's a good presumption that...
I guess more of my question is the CCA says... she had been made aware of GR's complaint against appellant, but had no reason to expect that incident to be raised in the course of HN's encounter with appellant. But there's no citation to a record or any explanation of why the CCA came to that conclusion. Do you know what they based that on? I mean, they're basically saying, yeah, she knew that GR had made this complaint to her about him, but she had no reason to believe that he was going to bring that up when he spoke to her.
As to that latter point, that she would have no reason to know that he would have brought up that complaint to her, I'm not sure where in the record that would be, Your Honor. There's no support for that. As to the first point, though, that HN did have knowledge of GR's report, that came directly from a superior officer.
Okay, I have one question.
Yes, Chief Judge.
Going back to the victim thing, if you have engaged in some sort of sexual encounter and you are thinking, well, now what happens to me? Under your theory, the best thing to do is hightail it to the victim advocate and spill yourself because it's all going to be immunized. Whether, in fact, you're ending up being the accused in this case or not, doesn't that run counter to the expressed purpose of the rule? I mean, you know, under your theory, the accused ought to get to the victim advocate as fast as possible before the victim. And plus, what does that do to the victim advocate if the victim then shows up? It's like representing two people with adverse interests at the same time.
And coincidentally, Chief Judge, the victim advocate in this case recognized she had a conflict of interest when she had knowledge both of GR's report and Seaman Harpole's report. But, and just to briefly conclude, at the time of that communication, Seaman Harpole was not an accused. Seaman Harpole was in no different position than the alleged victim in this case.
So basically what we're going on is his subjective feelings of aggravation, a feeling aggrieved, a feeling victimized.
He was a person who suffered direct physical or emotional harm from what could have been a sexual offense. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Counsel, does the rule require victim advocates to disbelieve victims or to question the veracity of victims in order to have a privilege, and that they only extend the privilege to those victims that they believe are providing a truthful statement?
Hopefully not, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Chief Judge Stukin and members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Connor Simpson, and along with Mr. Stephen McCleary, I represent the United States. The military judge did not abuse her discretion in admitting appellant statements to the victim advocate, as that statement was non-confidential under MRE 514. Further, defense counsel's decision not to file a motion to suppress appellant's statement did not amount to ineffective assistance of counsel, as appellant has failed to show there was a reasonable probability of success for that motion, and that defense counsel's performance was objectively unreasonable under prevailing professional norms. In looking to the text of MRE 514, this court should apply the analysis in United States v. Matthews and first look to the plain meaning of the rule. Under the plain meaning of the rule, it is clear that the phrase "in furtherance of the rendition of advice and assistance to the alleged victim" did not include Seaman Childers as a third party that falls within that exception. First, and as the military judge did find in her pretrial motion, the meaning of the word rendition means to give to someone. When reading that phrase in conjunction with the second portion of the text, it is clear that the only individual that can provide assistance or advice to the alleged victim is the victim advocate. Therefore, in determining which third party is actually in furtherance of that service, it is solely the victim advocate who can make that determination. In this case,
how do we know the victim advocate didn't make that decision in this case when the victim advocate created a zone for a private conversation which would include both the appellant in this case and the third party?
Your Honor, are you referring to bringing Seaman Childers and the appellant to the first class lounge? Although the record does indicate that the victim advocate did bring Seaman Childers and appellant to the first class lounge, she did so because that was the only private area located near her birthing area, and she didn't know what appellant was speaking to. But the fact that she wanted to maintain privacy of that conversation is different than whether or not that communication was confidential under MRE 514. And when you look to what is in the record as to her statements about Seaman Childers and his presence, She asks appellant whether or not his presence, he wants him to be present. Reading into that, that indicates that she had already made the determination that she did not believe he was, Seaman Childress was necessary for her own function.
Why didn't she tell him that then? Or did she?
Your Honor, the victim advocate did say, although the record says, is silent as to whether or not she said this would result in the privilege, the communication not being privileged, or that this would be an individual who would not fall within the third-party exception. The precedent of this court, specifically in looking to when a disclosure results in waiver, shows that it is not required that the appellant know or intentionally have that third party present.
No, I'm asking about your point that the victim advocate had already made the decision that this person was not in furtherance of assisting her, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
But my question is, if your point is that she has made that decision, why didn't she convey that to the accused and the third party sitting in front of her at the time? Now, you may not know, but I'm not trying to put you on the spot. You might not know. You say, I don't know.
Yes, Your Honor. It's the record's not clear as to what her intentions were in making that statement. All we have is that she notified the appellant that, asked the appellant whether or not he wanted the third party present. And based on that statement, that is her indicating that she did not make that determination. The third party was someone who fell within the exception.
Why wouldn't he have taken that as, like, basically that him staying here is okay, and I can still talk to you, and it will be quote-unquote private, given that she found them a private birthing area, and given that, you know, he's just some kid on a ship?
It's possible that he could have taken that interpretation, but in looking to how, I think a good analogy to raise is in looking to, under M. Murray 510, what it takes for an appellant who is this privilege holder to actually waive a communication. And in that instance, which is analogous to this in many ways, an appellant only has to have affirmative consent or voluntarily allow that disclosure to occur. In this case, that is clear that has been met by the appellant giving acknowledgement to the victim advocate that he wanted Seaman Childress to remain present. Anything else requiring that he has knowledge that Seaman Childress did not fall within the third-party exception or that he needed an intent to have him remain would be contrary to what the precedent is in terms of 510, and there really is not a distinction that should be made between those two incidents.
Well, 510 talks about circumstances in which it would be inappropriate to allow the claim of the privilege. Isn't that the underlying issue in this case? I'm not clear how 510 gets us any further here one way or another.
Your Honor, in speaking to the 510 aspect, I was looking at this court's precedent in United States v. Jasper. And
I'm looking at the rule.
Yes, Your Honor.
The rule requires a determination that it would be inappropriate to claim the privilege. Isn't that the issue that's before us in this case?
That is one part of the issue, Your Honor, and the government did raise that in their brief. In looking to the rule and both the court's precedent in United States v. Michelini and United States v. Jasper, the government does also argue that based on appellant's prior disclosure to Seaman Childress, moments before then speaking to the victim advocate, that is a circumstance where he not only made a disclosure that was a significant part of that communication he later made to the victim advocate, but it also results in a situation that is inappropriate inappropriate to maintain that privilege.
I'm not clear that I follow the argument here. Is your argument that 510 applies because he made a prior disclosure and that all the information was already out there, and therefore that nothing was disclosed in the conversation with the victim advocate that was privileged? Or is it the fact that he talked to somebody now make a circumstance in which nothing could happen within the victim advocate conversation that would make it privileged? I'm not sure which is your argument. I understand the first argument, but I'm not sure I understand the second argument.
In terms of your question, Your Honor, I would argue that based on the rule under 510 and what we look at, what is required under 510, the fact that he made a prior disclosure of the same exact statement moments before, that is a situation that it would be inappropriate to allow the subsequent privilege if this court were to deem that the communication to the victim advocate was privileged.
That would apply to any privilege. It's not, right? It's not a question of the victim advocate privilege. It's a question of, hey, you before you had this privilege, that communication that you're now saying is privileged, you said the same thing to somebody else in an unprivileged situation, therefore there's no privilege.
Yes, Your Honor. And looking to what we have, the facts that we have here, the appellant made intentionally, similar to the United States v. McElhaney, he made an intentional disclosure to Seaman Childers. And as we saw in United States, or we also saw in United States v. Jasper, that is more than what is required under, in order for a waiver to occur.
What credibility information did the government rely on in terms of believing her and not believing him about who had done what to whom?
Your Honor, in terms of when she made the report to the command about what?
Yeah, because, I mean, he's saying, you know, I don't remember anything that, you know, I went to get my backpack and she grabbed me and I don't remember what happened next, but I think I was assaulted. She says, I know I went back to the ship and I don't know what happened, but then I think I was assaulted. The government somehow says that she didn't get up to answer the door even though she doesn't remember what she did and charges him with both housebreaking or burglary and making a false official statement. The CCA disapproves his allegation that he's treated disparately because while he knows he's being investigated, he doesn't want to talk to the investigators about what happened to him, which seems pretty reasonable to me. What is going on?
Your Honor,
is there something that I'm not seeing in the record that caused this thing to transpire the way that it did? Is there some, you know, that he told someone that he was really a rapist or that he's a big liar and she isn't?
Your Honor,
because, I mean, this we have two young shipmates, right, both of whom say that they were drunk and don't remember what happened precisely, but they both feel that they've been taken advantage of. And one of them ends up with a sentence of 7 years. So I guess I'm asking, what else is there in the record? And you could say I don't have to answer that question, Judge Ryan, and you certainly don't, but I'm curious.
Your Honor, looking to the other witnesses that were available that were privy to the incident that is at issue here, both SK3 Robinson, who was one of the roommates, OS3 Putnam was also another roommate, and then looking to the testimony of the forensic analysis, Lieutenant Junior Grade Harris. The testimony of all those individuals supported, in terms of what the government viewed that, supported the position that SK3GR's version of events was more truthful. So in looking...
But more truthful how? Like, they both said that they were drunk and didn't remember.
Well, in terms of SK3GR's statement of she was asleep, she went back to the birthing area, she was asleep, and then she woke up and saw the appellant's face, the testimony of SK3G, or Robinson, indicates that she was woken up to appellant coming into the birthing area, opening the curtain to her rack, and asking where the victim lay. After that, she states that she didn't hear any noises from the victim, she didn't see the victim get up from the room after appellant left. And then OS3 Putnam also says the same thing, where she does not recall opening the door for appellant and does not recall the victim moving. So based on that testimony, that corroborates and goes to the fact that that supports SK3GR's version of the events. And then you add in the testimony of Lieutenant Junior Grade Harris, who stated that he removed an impacted tampon from the victim's vagina. That supports the SK3GR's version of events, as opposed to the limited statement that we have from the appellant that he went to the victim's room, knocked on the door, the victim grabbed his, or in this says SK3GR, grabbed his hand, and he doesn't remember anything else.
Counsel, let's assume that all the facts in this case are the same in a hypothetical. But in a hypothetical, the charges are brought against a third party, and either the government or the defense wants to use the testimony of the victim advocate in this case. that was made in this case? Can the individual claim the privilege, the individual who went to see the victim advocate and is now merely a witness in a separate court-martial? Can that person claim, under all the circumstances of this case, claim the privilege?
Your Honor, if the same circumstances applied, that individual would not be able to claim privilege because privilege did not exist because the communication would be non-confidential.
Okay. But in terms of, now the next hypothetical would be, suppose there's no third party present, and suppose that the individual making the statement to the victim advocate had never said that to anyone before. Could they claim the privilege?
Your Honor, if the circumstances are the same, so there's a third party who's present.
No third party present and no conversations with a third party. But the person says the exact same things that the individual said in this case. And the victim advocate later on just doesn't believe that individual. Does that victim advocate's decision to not believe the individual vitiate the privilege?
My apologies for not hearing your question correctly the first time, but that situation would be different if there was no third party and it's just solely the victim advocate and the victim. And if the victim advocate were then to make any statement about that statement or testify as to what the victim told him or her, that would arguably, yes, be privileged, but that's not the facts.
I understand that. Thank you.
If the victim advocate doesn't believe that they're having a privileged conversation and either knew or should have known that there was a conflict of interest, and instead of acting as though she was a victim advocate, went and made a statement to investigative services about her conversation with appellant, why isn't this an Article 31 case? Like, why isn't she a superior who knew or should have known that an incriminating statement was going to be forthcoming because she'd already had the conversation with the other victim, right, and didn't think she was having a privileged conversation because she had a person there and then traipsed down to relay the entire substance of the conversation to law enforcement. Why, under those circumstances, once the military judge denied the privilege issue, shouldn't the defense counsel have raised an Article 31B issue, and why shouldn't it have been granted? You understand what I'm saying? He can't have it both ways, but neither can you.
Yes, sir. I thank you for your question, Your Honor. In looking to that issue, first under whether or not the merits of a 31 Bravo motion, looking at the facts that we hear, and whether or not there would have been a reasonable probability of success for that motion, it is clear that this situation is far different than in situations where this court and where other courts have found that individual
partially, we don't know because the record isn't developed because the defense counsel at trial didn't develop it.
Your Honor, the defense counsel, the record does indicate, is full of facts that indicate that the victim advocate did not meet any of the parameters of requiring the Article 31 Bravo. Specifically, if you take one for looking at, or you first look at what capacity she was acting in, the facts are fairly clear that she was not acting in a disciplinary capacity. And even when you take into account her superior rank, the facts that we have can be easily distinguished from cases where a superior has been found to be acting in a disciplinary capacity based on their rank, such as United States v. Swift, United States v. Good, and also if you look at United States v. Dole and Dowell. All those instances have facts or circumstances where the individual is being spoken to is either suspected of an offense, that relationship between...
Well, you don't think that she suspected him of an offense based on what she already knew?
Although, in looking to that analysis, I would analogize it to the case in United States v. Dole, where the sergeant, so similar in rank to the accused, was not only the person who had found out or discovered the accused's larceny of rifles, but he was also on guard in the interview room with the individual and then asked the accused questions. That's not something we have here. We don't have her either.
No, she's pretending to be a sympathetic ear. I mean, this is one way you could look at it, right, which is she's purporting to be a sympathetic ear to whom he can tell his woes, right? But instead, she's going to go down to law enforcement and make a statement against him. right? I mean, you don't see that as potentially problematic? I'm not saying that that's the way that it would be concluded to have transpired, but that's one way to look at the facts. And you don't think that in that circumstance, if that's what she was planning to do, that she needed to say, hey, don't tell me anything, because I already think that you're a rapist.
Well, there's nothing indicating, based on her subjective intent that she's provided, that that was the case. She not only stated in the joint appendix that she viewed him as a victim, she was non-judgmental as to what he was saying to her, and also that she's required by Coast Guard SAPR policy to then take any unrestricted report and provide it to the command. And what we have in the record as to what she told the command was merely that a report of sexual assault has now been made by the appellant against SK3GR. And that's a slightly different situation than had she gone to command and spilled everything that was told and then was in that relationship under the guise of being a victim advocate but actually acting in law enforcement capacity.
How did she come to make the statement to law enforcement?
Her statement to CJIS was made 3 weeks later, and it's unclear as to how she came to make that communication, but it's likely that between that point in time of while they're underway, the government asked her to speak to a CJIS.
But if facts were to be developed in a debate hearing on ineffective assistance counsel, that after contemplating the decision, the victim advocate in this case decided that the person who came to see her was not telling the truth, and the victim advocate initiated the conversation with law enforcement officials, where would we be?
Your Honor, that is, although that's a potential situation, that is not something that would be required. Additional fact-finding is not necessary to make that determination, specifically because we have three instances of sworn statements by not only the victim advocate, but also Seaman Childers as to what occurred in that room. And what we're looking at as to what actually occurred in the room when she was making the questions to the appellant. And everything that we have, both from Seaman Childers saying that she did not take any notes, did not make any recordings, and the meeting lasted 5 minutes, and to her also statements that I just reiterated as to how she viewed the appellant, that's clear that...
But what's your answer to my question if she initiated the conversation with law enforcement officials?
I don't believe that would be dispositive of whether or not Article 31 Bravo communications...
It may not be dispositive, but wouldn't it develop a colorable claim in terms of trial defense counsel would have... It only made sense for them to pursue that issue before the court?
Your Honor, in terms of whether defense counsel should have raised that at trial?
Right, in the context of the ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
Your Honor, that is a potential argument that the defense counsel, or avenue that the defense counsel could have made, but in looking at whether or not her performance was deficient, both in United States v. Akbar and United States v. Maza, we're not here to second-guess the tactical decisions of the defense counsel. And that would be going against this court's precedent, Your Honor, going against the court's precedent in analyzing ineffective assistance counsel claims.
Where the court below, may I follow up with a question, Chief Judge? The court below indicated that there was a tactical decision here. So where is the tactical decision in terms of trying to avoid some negative consequence at trial? In an Article 39A session with a judge, and the defense counsel could have first litigated the privilege issue, and having lost the privilege issue, said, well, if the facts are that way, we now have a self-incrimination issue. What would be the negative consequence that would have promoted a tactical decision to not raise the Article 31 issue?
Well, in a sense, you'd be arguing against yourself moments after she argued.
But you already lost. I mean, you've lost, right? I mean, you've lost. You make this great privilege issue, say, it was privilege, 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 I needed my shipmate there, I couldn't render my statement without him, and the military judge is having none of it, right, and says goodbye. Right, so you've lost. That's over. So what does the competent person do next?
She would then be arguing that the victim advocate was not acting in a victim advocate capacity after she had just argued she was acting in a victim advocate capacity and say that she, under the test for Article 31 Bravo, one of the things she was doing was acting in a law enforcement capacity. And that would have reduced her credibility with the military judge, and that previous argument would still have been...
Doesn't a military judge know that you can make these kinds of arguments? He's not going to hold it against the defense counsel, is he?
Argue the alternative.
Sure.
Yes, Your Honor, you can argue in the alternative, but once again, what the purview of this court's analysis in looking at this ineffective assistance counsel claim is whether or not her choice was reasonable among the available alternatives. She made a decision that the privilege claim was stronger, and we're not here to second-guess whether or not, based on the success of that motion, whether or not it was reasonable and she was ineffective.
Do we have a statement from the trial defense counsel saying, I made a choice, and I believe that the choice foreclosed me making any later choice?
We do not.
If she said that or he said that, would that be a correct statement of the law or trial strategy?
We do not have a statement from the defense counsel, but that's not necessary in looking to whether or not her choice was reasonable. And based on her analysis, the privilege claim, as seen in how she contested it during motions and during her actual argument, was arguably a better claim. And making that decision, that was reasonable and did not amount to ineffective assistance counsel.
Thank you, counsel. Does the appellant have rebuttal?
Counsel, should you be seeking a debate hearing here on the ineffective assistance of counsel claim?
Only, Your Honor, if this court does not find that the statements made were privileged. I believe if the statements were privileged...
So you're arguing in the alternative.
I am arguing in the alternative.
Are you sure that's effective?
I'll provide you an affidavit. Under either theory, to keep the statements out... The statements that were admitted were prejudicial to Seaman Harpool. The Article 107 charge is solely based on the testimony of Petty Officer Nitt. Seaman Childers would not have testified that the alleged victim in this case opened the door. That's evident from the testimony that he gave at trial. The Article 130 housebreaking charge was based on the testimony of Seaman Nitt. The government in this case, in their opening statement, said that Seaman Harpool had a specific intent to commit a sexual assault because it was his way of dealing with marital stress and the problems that he was having with his wife that he learned about while on patrol. Seaman Childers testified that his wife did not cheat on him during patrol. Wife may have cheated on him earlier, but at the time of the patrol, they were fine. And then in the Article 120 specifications, the general theme that what Seaman Harpool did here was blame the victim, avoid responsibility, and lie. It spiraled. All of the statements were the theme of him coming up with this story that he didn't remember. Obviously, he must have known because we have a victim who's testifying something to the contrary. So he must be a liar. It's basically the government's charging decision in this case. And that, if that's the way we're going to do it, we might as well charge him with a false official statement for earning a plea of not guilty because he clearly knows he's guilty. This case was a weak case. This case had a victim who was suffering from memory impairment, but yet even when the government called her on a redirect or recalled her to the stand, she testified that she knew she had sex, she just wasn't sure who she had sex with. And once she had recognized that there was a T-shirt in the room that did not belong to her ex-boyfriend, she recognized it must have been Seaman Harpool. Seaman Harpool, of course, did not give a statement to CGIS, and therefore this was a weak case where they had no solid evidence other than a he said, she said of two people who do not remember what happened in that birthing area. And for these reasons, the appellant asks that this court set aside the findings and sentence.
Thank you, counsel. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted, and the court is in recess until 10:30.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 10:30.